This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to What Makes It Great. I'm David Ozenberg. This, our third season of broadcasting this very popular series, as hosted by composer, conductor, author, and commentator Rob Capello. For over 20 years, Rob has brought the joy and wonder of classical music and unraveling some of its mysteries to audiences of all ages and backgrounds. One of the greatest communicators since Leonard Bernstein, Rob's programs are characterized by his unique ability to create that aha moment for his audiences and collaborators, whatever their level of musical sophistication or naivete. Rob's work brings music into people's lives, opening new ears to musical experiences and helping people to listen actively rather than just hear. Rob's range of activities is astonishingly broad, including his What Makes It Great presentations, now going on for over 20 years in New York and Boston, his family compositions and family music events, his city pieces, corporate programs, and residencies with institutions as diverse as the National Gallery of Canada and Stanford University. The reach of his interactive events and activities is wide, from Native American tribal communities in Montana and inner-city high school students in Louisiana to audiences in Kyoto and Kuala Lumpur, and from little ones barely out of diapers to musicologists in Ivy League programs. His career has been marked by numerous major awards and grants. He won first prize in the Fontainebleau Casa des Sioux Piano Competition and was second prize winner of the Entel Dorati Conductors Competition with the Detroit Symphony. He's also been a recipient of an Exxon Meet the Composer grant and numerous ASCAP awards. He's conducted many of North America's orchestras, as well as new works of musical theater, ranging from the Tony Award-winning Nine on Broadway to the premiere of Frida for the opening of the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. At 19, Rob interrupted his academic work at Yale University to study with the legendary Nadia Boulanger. 2 years later, after graduating Phi Beta Kappa from Yale, he continued his studies at Eastman School of Music. After graduating from Eastman, he returned to Yale, where he was assistant professor for 6 years at the university. He dedicates his summer months to writing and composing new music. He was the first composer to be granted the rights to set Dr. Seuss's words to music, and his Green Eggs and Ham has been called the most successful piece written for families this half century. There's a CD featuring Nathan Gunn and Isabel Leonard in two of his most popular family music compositions, Chris von Alsberg's Polar Express and Dr. Seuss's Gertrude McFuzz. He's appeared on the NBC Today Show. He's presented a special What Makes It Great for broadcast on PBS's Live from Lincoln Center. And he's written two books, the award-winning All You Have to Do Is Listen and What Makes It Great, the first book of its kind to be especially designed for the iPad with embedded musical examples. And he's currently finishing a new book on the American Songbook. In past episodes, Rob has featured songbooks of great composers. He's also focused on major masterpieces from the chamber music and even solo instrumental realm. But on this program, we will feature symphonic music and music of one of the great romantic symphonists, the Symphony No. 8 in G major by the Czech composer Antonín Dvořák. And Rob will welcome as his special guests and will be conducting the same ensemble who performed the Haydn Symphony No. 104 in the last episode of What Makes It Great, the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia. Chamber Symphonia performs standard and contemporary works composed for chamber orchestra. It was created as the principal training ensemble for students in the graduate program in orchestral performance at this school on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Manhattan School of Music seeks to nourish musicians of the highest artistic caliber and prepare them intensively in their large ensembles to perform the orchestral repertoire for careers as symphonic players. Chaired by former New York Philharmonic Concertmaster Glenn Dichterow, the program's faculty is made up of principal players of major New York orchestras. We'll send you now down to the stage of Merkin Concert Hall at the Kauffman Music Center in Midtown Manhattan for What Makes It Great with Rob Capello and the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia.
Good evening and welcome to our fourth and final What Makes It Great program of the season. How many of you have come to all four programs? Amazing. You'll do really well on the final exam. Fantastic. We have any newcomers coming for the very first time? Never been to one before? Oh, we do. And they're all right down there. Okay. Very good, good, good. For newcomers, program's divided up into three parts. It's listed in your programs, I think. Discussion, demonstration, approximately an hour. Intermission, then complete performance, tumultuous applause. Then we go straight into a short Q&A with the entire orchestra, where you have the rare opportunity of asking anyone on stage. And please talk to the musicians. I've told them they have to answer whatever you ask them. So please talk to them. You can ask anything you like about the program, Dvorak, what it's like to be a student at the Manhattan School, their thoughts on the future of music, anything you like, and we'll do our best to answer. Please stay till the very end. It's one of the most fun parts, and your questions will be recorded for WWFM, so please ask brilliant questions. One last final question for you. How many of you came to the program we did last season, which I think of as a prequel to tonight's program, on Dvorak's A Major Piano Quintet, written just 2 years before this symphony, 1887? Oh, fantastic. You're definitely ahead of the game. Good. In that program, I talked about Dvorak's intimate, intricate relationship with Brahms, how in 1874, when Brahms was world famous and Dvorak was an unknown, starving, penniless composer in Bohemia, Brahms, a judge on the jury dispensing the Austrian state stipendium, was so overwhelmed by the music that Dvorak submitted that he awarded him enough money to enable him to survive and focus exclusively on composition. He then got his own publisher, Simrock, to publish Dvorak's music, which almost instantly made him rich and famous. It's not quite like that when I got my first Schirmer contract, but a little differently back those days. He then got an influential editor to also write a major article about Dvorak, and when Dvorak went to America, and we'll talk about that next season as well, he offered to copy edit and proofread Dvorak's music for free. Finally, believing that no composer from Bohemia could possibly be a success without moving to the big city, without moving to Vienna, he offered Dvorak his estate and his money if he would relocate. The fact that Dvorak refused, remaining Czech both geographically as well as musically, was actually the key to his success. How he managed to blend what seems almost unblendable, Brahms's world, the essence of conservative, classical, Germanic compositional craft, with Dvorak's own unique Bohemian folk music world, to create something new and fresh, was the story of the A Major Quintet last year, and in a different way, it's the story of the Eighth Symphony tonight. And since I've got a lot to tell you, let's get started. So I want to start not at the beginning of this piece, but in the middle with the slow movement, where you can see some of Dvorak's most distinctive traits incredibly clearly. Here's the heartfelt, emotional opening phrase of the slow movement, a highly unusual phrase that seems to change keys three times before deciding what key the movement's actually in. Here's the beginning of the slow movement. Do they not sound fantastic? Yes? Since this phrase is classic Dvorak, let's go back and see how it's put together. How many of you came to the program we did about 100 years ago on Appalachian Spring? When Copland wrote his ballet Appalachian Spring for Martha Graham, he described her choreography as seemingly, but only seemingly, simple. And the same thing can be said about Dvorak's music. It is seemingly, but only seemingly, simple. This heartfelt opening idea is lovely and seemingly straightforward. Simply a scale that goes up and back down and then resolves. He could have easily simply started at the top of the scale with a long note and done this, what I call long, then resolve. Sing that version. The words are long, then resolve. It's right in the manuscript. Here we go. Sing. Long, then, but do the beautiful hushed diminuendo that they did. Here we go. Long. Now every note softer. Wow, not bad at all. But instead he begins with urgency and emotion, a striking three-note upbeat preceding that long note, that crescendo. So instead of just starting here, he adds three notes before it, that crescendo. Four notes go up. Then resolve. So do that with urgency and emotion. Sing. Four notes go up. Then resolve. You are not going to believe what's going to happen with four notes go up. Here's what it sounds like in the orchestra. Surely no better than you. Four notes go up. Then resolve. Now that idea finishes in a major key, but without a clear resolution. But we assume this is going to be the key of the movement. But he then immediately repeats the idea lower in a minor key, deepening the emotion, and then we think, well, maybe that's the key of the movement. Here are the two gestures together. The first one. Four notes go up, then re. Is this the key of the movement, we say? Now, lower and minor. Four notes go up, then resolve. Now, he could have done it a third time like this. Four notes go up, then re. But instead of that version, four notes go up, then resolve. He subtly changes the ending. So instead of this, he does this. And you turn to your neighbor in disbelief. And then we finally shift key a third time and finally arrive in a minor key, which is actually the key of the movement, which is then reduced to a single note in a strikingly unusual unison of nothing but third and fourth horns and timpani to end the phrase. So here's what you expect. And I want you to really expect it. I'll know if you do. Here's what he does instead. Four notes go up. Change. Shift keys. Whoa, we're here. This is the key of the movement. Now, a unison. It becomes a single note. So within this single phrase, our simple little opening idea has been four notes go up. It became four notes go up. It became four notes go up. And now, see if you get this, it became four notes go up. Four notes go up. And then finally resolve. Amazing. So now we think we know the key of the movement. Now watch this. He takes that little four notes go up fragment, does it two octaves higher with a slightly different rhythm in the flute, four notes go up, and that becomes the second idea of the movement. Everything has come from four notes go up, now becomes four notes go up, and then all we add is leap down, and we have the second idea of the movement. Four notes go up, then leap down. What's going to come from four notes go up and leap down is absolutely astonishing. So here's a second idea of the movement. Four notes go up, then leap down. Four notes go up, then leap, then a beautiful clarinet duet. Dvorak was enormously influenced by the folk music that he heard in the Bohemian countryside, but instead of quoting that material directly, he allowed it to absorb and color his own musical language. Now here's a normal version that I wrote of that Bohemian clarinet duet, kind of the urban version instead of the Bohemian countryside version. Here's what it should have sounded like in a normal theory textbook. That's the normal version. Now listen to the wonderful accidentals that he adds to make it bohemian. back to our foreign notes go up, then repeat the whole combination, the duet. Now start to work with the ideas. Four notes go up. Just one fragment. Just leap down. One fragment. Leap down. Change the key. Leap down. Leap down. Leap down. Back to the duet. Just the leap downs. Now watch. Echo pianissimo. The strings take the leap down. Leap. Change the harmony. Just leap downs. Head back to minor. Suddenly the bass drops out. Just strings on leap down. Do it half its speed. Leap. Solo timpani brings us back to the opening. Transform. Fill in the blanks with this. Do it lower. Four notes go up. Then resolve. Fill in the answer. What makes Dvorak great? The power of changing only one note. After hearing these two powerful versions of this opening idea, four notes go up, and then you hear four notes go up, we expect a third time to hear four. So really expect this. But instead we get a soft version, unaccompanied in flute and oboe, just and change one note. Not everyone expects this. Really expect that with every part of your being. But instead of, we get with that exquisite chord. And if you don't love that chord, we don't want you here. Okay? That straight from the heart moment, that is the kind of moment that makes Dvorak great. So everyone sit there and expect this. But here's what we get instead. Intimate as that phrase is, it now gets even more beautiful and even more intimate. The melody repeats exactly. The same melody gets repeated, but the harmony underneath changes and it gets even softer. So instead of the first version you just heard, we get the same melody, but now it turns into this. Stretch the first two notes. And resolve to end the section in major. Now, the transition to the middle section of this movement is absolutely magical, and again, only seemingly simple. For your final exam, does this little transition figure in the bass sound familiar in any way? Once again, four notes go up. What we started with now becomes four notes go up, plunk, plunk. Four notes go up, plunk, plunk. To translate, by the way, apologies to the horns for the plunk, plunk. That's actually the French horns there. This becomes our transition to the magical middle section of the movement like this. Watch this magic here, suddenly. Seven bars of the same harmony. A Dvorak melody in the woodwind. All the same chord. Change. And a duet to end. Woodwind's fantastic in that example, yeah? Now, the turn to the opening of this movement is absolutely colossal. Like Beethoven, Dvorak loved to bring back initially soft ideas loudly, not just for the simple shock value of repeating or shouting something that you had initially whispered, but for the complete transformation of the idea's fundamental meaning. So listen to this stunningly powerful preparation for the return of the main theme, and then the heroic return of that intimate theme that follows. Pretty terrific stuff, right? After extensive development of material that you now know and will surely follow perfectly after intermission when you hear the performance, the opening returns one last time. And as is so often the case with Dvorak, the ending provides a completely satisfying sense of ending, closure, and completion. Here's the ending of the movement. Beautiful, beautiful string melody, the moral of the story. Four notes go up, then re-stop. The scherzo movement is nearly always the most traditional movement in a romantic or a classical period symphony, but even in this fundamentally traditional scherzo, Dvorak's approach is uniquely his own. Instead of writing a traditional scherzo, he writes a kind of a graceful bohemian waltz with actually the same tempo marking, Allegretto Grazioso, that Brahms uses in the third movement of his first and second symphonies. This is Brahms's world filtered through Dvorak's Czech sensibility, a bohemian waltz. Here's the beginning. Playing viola, boy, they really sound good, don't they? I'm telling you. Playing viola in the Prague Orchestra for so many years gave Dvorak a tremendous appreciation of the importance of the accompanying parts in a symphony, since he sat there for years having to play them. And the symphonies are filled with fantastic parts for the accompanying instruments. So let's look layer by layer at this seemingly simple opening waltz texture. First, let's start with the melody. As is so often the case, repetition is the key to a memorable tune. A heart, the basic idea, is simply a scale divided into two parts, but instead of just even notes, sing that the words are even notes, ready, go. Even. He does the first note longer, and then the second two faster, and instead of, it becomes long, and then even notes. So do that, and a little of this with your body helps a lot. Here we go. And to sing, long, and then even. That's your basic idea, long and then even notes. Then he does the exact same idea lower, long and then even notes, A third time exactly would be this. Long. He changes only one note, the last one. And then finishes with sighs. Sigh, sigh, and resolve. Here's what the melody sounds like alone in the strings. Arpeggio long. Arpeggio long, and then even long, and then even. Third time, change the last note, sigh. Now listen to just the woodwind accompaniment, which you normally miss and is so subtle. You'll hear two double overlapping parts. You'll hear the bassoon and the oboe doing this. But you'll also hear the clarinet and the flute doing. See if you can hear just that without the melody. Flute. Now we're going to add in the string accompaniment to see if you can hear it all. So don't be distracted by the gorgeous melody. See if you can hear them as well. You can be a little distracted by the gorgeous melody. Here we go. Arpeggio long. Arpeggio long. Repeat and decorate. So often rhythm connects ideas that would otherwise not be connected. I'm going to play the first two measures of long and then even notes. And as soon as I finish, I just want you to clap the rhythm I just played. So long, now you clap. Now I'm going to play the second idea, the first two measures of the second idea of the movement. As soon as I finish it, you clap it. Now you clap. That rhythm connects two ideas that otherwise would sound completely different, and that is the rhythm of the entire next section. Once again, the clarity with which Dvorak presents his ideas makes it easy to follow his thought. Each statement in the woodwinds is immediately copied by the strings, and it's all dum, bum, 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 the same rhythm like this. Long and an even copy. Do it lower. Shorter and overlap. The transition to the middle section of this movement is actually fantastic, and it uses one of Brahms's favorite devices called hemiola. Have I ever told you my hemiola story before? Ask me during the Q&A about the hemiola story. It's a really fantastic story. Hemiola simply means taking six beats and alternating groups of threes and groups of twos. So what I want you to do is count three bars of three, three bars of two, one bar of three, and then say, and stop. So I'll demonstrate first. So what you're going to do is 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and stop. Okay, let's try it without them. Here we go. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and stop. One more time, a little more bohemian. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and stop. Now do that very quietly as they play it, and you'll see how we transition, okay? Here we go. 1, 2, 3, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and stop. Got it? All right. Let's repeat that example one more time. Don't say a word. Just appreciate it. Here we go. I'll do the counting. 1, 2, 3, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and stop. Fantastic. That's the transition. Now, the trio or the middle section of a scherzo movement is traditionally the simplest moment in an entire symphony, and this one is a perfect example. The melody is relatively straightforward. Once again, it's only rhythm that makes it not ordinary. Even note pause, even note pause, becomes just with a little dot, dot, and a pause, dot, and a pause. And except for one fantastic little Czech decoration, every single group of two measures has that same rhythm. It's dot and a pause, dot and a pause, dot Anna, but not pause, dot Anna. That's what makes it great, that little. And then dot Anna, pause. We start to repeat, dot Anna, pause, but now instead of, we go dot Anna, pause, higher, dot Anna, always the same rhythm, dot Anna, pause, dot Anna. That's always the great moment. Dot and a pause. That's the melody. But though the melody's relatively straightforward, the accompaniment, once again, those inner parts for Dvorak, the accompaniment is incredibly elegant. Instead of just playing straight eighth notes, which would be normal orchestration, there's an elegant pause and a beautiful interlocking with the timpani rhythm. So instead of this, we get pause, timpani, pause. Timpani, a beautiful, elegant rhythm. So see if you can hear that underneath that rhythm of the going on in the woodwinds. And also holding it all together is a kind of what we call Alberti bass in the cello part going. So see if you can hear all of that going on. This is going on. And then that wonderful melody, dot and a pause. See if you can hear it all together. Dot and a pause, dot and a pause. So the strings take over the melody for the second part of the tune and build to this rich climax before winding down to return and repeat the opening idea one more time with another subtle passage in Hemiola right before the return. Here's a version. Now the bump, bump is in the timpani and the trumpet as well. As in a normal scherzo, this whole opening section repeats, and a brief, brilliant coda ends the movement in spectacularly clever fashion. That is, again, seemingly, but only seemingly, simple. Up to the coda, whole movement has been in three beats to a bar. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. In the coda, Dvorak takes that trio tune and turns it from three beats in a measure to two beats in a measure in the woodwind. So instead of one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, it becomes one, two, one, two. Got it? That's subtlety here. One more time. One, two, three, one. Becomes, and then continues. If that's not hard enough to hear when I do it, on top of it, he puts a fantastic little tune, brand new, this wonderful Czech tune, so you barely even notice the subtle trio tune in three beats being turned into two beats underneath it. See if you can hear both parts, and then the tune above it. Switch to- parts just switched. Now the brass have the new tune, while the trio tune is in the strings. And the surprise ending, it's a kind of an, oh yeah, Hollywood ending, is absolutely fantastic. Hard to believe Dvorak actually wrote this ending. I mean, that is a fantastic ending, right? So having looked at the two inner movements, now all we need to do is look at the frame, the opening, and the closing movement. The sense of this symphony being seemingly, but only seemingly simple, actually begins with the opening of the opening movement, which actually starts both without introduction, plunging in immediately to a theme with no preparation whatsoever, and as an introduction to the music that actually follows it. Though the title page and the key signature say that this is a symphony in G major with a fast tempo marking, Allegro con brio, the symphony actually begins in G minor, not major, with a broad flowing tune for the cellos that sounds more like andante, a kind of a slower tempo than allegro con brio, and it only changes to major at the last possible instant. As we're hearing this with no introduction whatsoever, we're saying to ourselves, is this actually the main theme of the symphony? Some kind of an introduction? Questions hang in the air. Lovely. Since this cadence that you just heard brings us to a major key, and that flute theme you just heard sounds so themey, we think, well, maybe that's surely the main theme of the symphony. So here's that cadence and that flute theme, and also notice how high-pitched and bright the string chord sounds when it enters, and then the flute sounds like it's in the stratosphere because of the low pitch of the brass cadence that precedes it. So here's that cadence down low, then sort of angelic strings, and then in the stratosphere, the flute. Trombone, strings up high, flute, main theme, work with the last two notes. Tuba, timpani. And now, then all of a sudden, we get music that actually sounds fast and clearly is an introduction. This is clearly getting ready for something, introductory music. Doesn't sound more introductory than this. All right, having heard an opening theme that turned out to be an introduction to another introduction, we're wondering if we're ever going to actually hear the main theme of this symphony, and what follows in the cellos sound for a few instants like it might be, well, this is really the main theme, but then it too starts sounding introductory and starts to develop, and finally that gentle unaccompanied flute tune returns powerfully in the full orchestra as a main theme. So for a moment, we think this might be a main theme. Sounds like a theme. The flute theme. Now it's full orchestra. This isn't like a real concert. You can applaud whenever you want. No rules and regulations here. Now, as soon as that theme announces itself, however, Dvorak immediately starts transitioning to the second theme, leaving us completely unsure of what's going to turn out to be important and matter in all of this introductory music. Now, the movement's second theme, once it finally arrives, is a superb example of Dvorak's effortless fusion of his bohemian folk music influences and a classical symphonic technique. When the theme starts, it sounds like a kind of a minor key, bohemian peasant tune, a kind of folk-like duet for two clarinets who have escaped from a wandering Hungarian peasant band. Something like, repeats, third time. But gradually, Dvorak starts working with shorter and shorter fragments of the tune, switching from key to key in a remarkably sophisticated symphonic manner. So we start off like a peasant tune for the two clarinets. Just work with the beginning. And higher. Shorter fragments. Change the rhythm. The movement as a whole is one of Dvorak's most complex movements, and the opening introduction that you've probably long ago forgotten actually returns twice in the movement to clarify the form and let you know where you are. The first time it returns, it starts the middle central development section of the movement like this. For a while, it's an exact repeat. Just like the first time. Strings come in, flute, but now dissonance and an echo starts a duet with the oboe, more intense. Ability to transform his seemingly simple themes is absolutely remarkable, and both that naive, innocent opening flute tune and that brief, proud cello fragment that for a moment seemed like it was going to be a tune. Return and transform their character completely during the development section, but always in clear, gettable ways. We start off by taking that flute tune and turning it into like this. Echo. Duet with clarinet and bassoon. Ease the rhythm. The cello fragment. Change the key in the oboe. The return to the opening theme begins with another one of those transformations of that seemingly simple flute theme, now into a dark, brooding, minor key Slavonic version. And it finally returns us to the opening of the whole movement, you remember. Stunningly transformed into a brilliant duet for two trumpets, who I hope will stand up when they get to that brilliant transformation with the two trumpets over furious string scales. A complete rethinking of a theme that we barely understood the first time we actually heard it. So now suddenly becomes this. Thank you.
just two. Here we go. English horn to clarinet to flute overlapping with oboe and pluck. Bravo for those trumpets, yes? Once that opening theme is returned, all of the important material from that exposition comes back to clarify the form and finally let us know what matters and what doesn't matter. And after clearing up what had initially been so confusing, the movement comes to a powerful ending with the blazing trumpets, but we will save the lips of the blazing trumpeters for the performance itself. Now, the fourth movement is a theme and variations movement, but it's a theme and variations movement of a highly original kind. It begins with an extremely unusual introduction for two solo trumpets. Now, you know, any time a movement begins with a martial, fortissimo trumpet solo, it immediately suggests something sort of military, some kind of a call to battle. But I remember when I was a teenager, I went to Tanglewood, and I was watching Raphael Kubelik conduct a rehearsal of this piece. And when he got to this moment, he said, "Gentlemen, in Bohemia, the trumpets never call to battle. They call to the dance." I've always remembered that from when I was 13 years old. So after this vigorous call to the dance, the trumpet fanfare finally quiets itself, it fades into the distance, leaving behind only its poetic resonance, a little solo timpani part playing just the rhythm of the trumpet's four notes. So here's that call to the dance or call to battle, depending on whether you're Bohemian or American here. Passes to clarinets, horn and timpani. Fantastic. Though the theme of the fourth, you can always applaud for trumpets. Though the theme of this theme and variation movement that follows could not sound simpler and more spontaneous, Dvorak actually wrote 9 drafts of just the theme before he was actually satisfied. In classic theme and variation style, the tune is in 2 halves, and both halves are repeated. It begins with a simple little arpeggio. For non-musicians, if this is a chord playing one at a time, it's an arpeggio. It begins with nothing more than this. What's going to happen with those 3 notes is absolutely astonishing. Here's the theme of the theme and variations. And it repeats. Part 2. And it repeats. I mean, don't those cellos sound fantastic over there? Now, for a short while, the piece acts like a traditional theme and variation movement. In the first variation, the tune is now in the cello and the bass and the bassoons. And for four measures, it actually copies the theme exactly before changing it, though with now a whole different heavy fortissimo character. Now, here's just the bass line of that first variation. You can easily follow the original theme. Remember, the original theme went like this. Here's just the bass line. For four measures, you can follow that exactly, like this. The arpeggio, do the idea, do it lower, third time, and change. And it repeats, just like the melody for four bars. Lower, third time, and change. On top of this, Dvorak puts a vigorous upper string part, which turns that original intimate, heartfelt theme now into a vigorous march like this. And repeat. Works similarly. Once again, the bass line copies the original tune exactly for four measures before changing the ending. Originally, remember, it went like this. Now the bass line itself just goes like this. Four bars are the same. But then it changes and repeats. Exactly the theme and changes. Above this, Dvorak puts a fantastic flying scale that passes from viola to second violins to first violins, and it sounds absolutely magnificent. Here's the combination. Viola, seconds, firsts, and it repeats. Lovely in that first variation is exciting. Up to this point, the piece is following the path of a traditional theme and variations. But just as we're sitting back, settling in, waiting to hear a few more lovely variations, the piece explodes. The tempo speeds up. Dvorak uses only the opening fragment of the tune, and the whole orchestra bursts in with blaring French horn, well, exciting, thrilling French horns, blaring French horns, kicking the piece into a whole new thrilling gear. Suddenly that little opening turns into this. Now, this faster tempo not only brings a whole new set of variations, including a fantastic famous one for the flute that we will save for the performance itself, but also new material as well. And any idea of a kind of simple theme and variations movement completely disappears. Suddenly, we find ourselves listening to this quirky, bizarre, off-key, minor key march like this. Before we know it, the whole orchestra bursts in to work with and massively develop nothing more than the first two notes of the theme. Suddenly, a standard theme and variation movement has become an incredibly intense, sophisticated development section. Now, just the first two notes, work with it in the trombones. Of the piece climbs. climaxes it in unbelievably thrilling fashion with this incredible rising scale that just gets higher and higher and higher. I was thinking of telling the second violins to start down here and then gradually stand up as they played it, but it gets too high for all that. It rises, and then finally, that unaccompanied trumpet fanfare, that call to the dance that began the movement, returns now, gloriously played by the full orchestra. One of the great moments in the piece, one of the great moments in all Dvorak, and hopefully one of the great moments in your recent lives. Here we go. That's a pretty great moment, right? Somehow Dvorak manages to lower the intensity, the storm subsides, and that intimate opening theme returns, kind of like a recapitulation to bring a kind of calm to the proceedings. Somehow we find ourselves back to this. The piece remarkably becomes more and more intimate. A lovely string variation is followed by one for the clarinet over shimmering strings like this. One final variation for the strings is absolutely heartbreaking, and it has that unique feeling that you get in nearly every major work of Dvorak, a feeling that he's somehow speaking to you straight from the heart with no pretense whatsoever, that he's telling you important truths without any pretense of any kind. Time seems to stand still. This is the kind of moment that truly makes Dvorak great. With only the first three notes of the theme. Half speed. The moral of the story. This exquisitely intimate moment, somehow the truth in the center of the whole piece, passes by, and then one final incredible, blazing, glorious ending coda ends the movement, turning our opening of the whole movement, remember, into a triumphant trombone fanfare like this. Just one quick final thought, and then we'll take our intermission. You know, it's amazing how much can be contained in a name. As I mentioned earlier, Brahms's German publisher, Simrock, became Dvorak's publisher at Brahms's insistence. And from the beginning of their relationship, Simrock always insisted on printing Dvorak's first name in his German form as Anton, rather than in its Czech form as Antonín, as Dvorak wished. They eventually compromised in Solomon split the baby in half fashion on A-N-T period. I think that's such a brilliant solution. But the issue caused tension throughout the relationship. And one of the main reasons why Dvorak ultimately broke his contract with Simrock and allowed the English publisher Novella to publish the Eighth Symphony was not only that they were willing to pay more money, but they were willing to put Antonin, not Anton, on the title page. For Dvorak, Novella's willingness to acknowledge his ethnic identity was absolutely crucial. He was Czech, not German, Antonin, not Anton, Dvorak, not Brahms, and he had struggled throughout his entire career to create a symphonic style that would allow him to be just that. One of my favorite quotations from the brilliant writer on mythology, Joseph Campbell, is, "The privilege of a lifetime is being who you are." I love that. The privilege of a lifetime is being who you are, not who others think we should be, like Simrock or Brahms, but who we actually are. But how do we become who we are? Well, Campbell's famous advice was, follow your bliss, which for Dvorak meant bringing all of himself to his music, not excluding the bohemian folk music elements that he had previously thought were not serious enough to belong in a symphony or not classical enough to belong in a symphony. Once he embraced that choice, he found his voice and quickly became as famous as Brahms. In the end, for better or for worse, who we are is all that we have and all that we can authentically offer. Dvorak could never be Brahms, but he could be Dvorak. Or as Oscar Wilde put it so succinctly and so wittily, be yourself, everyone else is taken. Thank you and enjoy the performance.
Rob Capello in the Manhattan School of Music Chamber Symphonia on this episode of What Makes It Great. We'll be back in a moment with Rob conducting this ensemble in a complete performance of the Symphony No. 8 in G Major, Opus 88, composed in 1889 by Antonin Dvorak. You're listening to What Makes It Great, an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and WWFM.org.